welcome back or welcome to the On Coaching Podcast with Steve Magnus. That's me and John Marcus, my good friend and colleague. So before we get to the show this week, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Final Surge. What is Final Surge? It's an online training log and coaching platform designed for athletes, coaches, and teams. And I use it myself with my post-collegiate athletes, and it's awesome because it allows me to keep track of what everyone's doing, allows them to make comments back, note injuries, there's a little health monitor they can fill out with every run, and also allows me to assign training and workouts and all that good stuff. It's my one-stop shop for coaching, and it has honestly 100% changed my life from a coaching standpoint and made it where I can do things now and take on athletes now that I couldn't just a couple years ago. So they're running a 10% discount if you use the coupon code ONCOACHING. That's all caps. The link is in the show note, but highly suggest it. Final Surge. And without further ado, we're on to this week's podcast, which has a special guest, Ben Cohen, the author of the book, The Hot Hand, a new book that is on the science of streaks, which we'll get into. And he's also the author of one of the more popular articles going around on Dr. Anthony Fauci and his basketball days during his high school career and how that has shaped his leadership. So Ben's a really smart guy. I think you're going to really enjoy this podcast. Lots of discussion on coaching or on topics that apply to coaching. And then also we get to the heart of how to make decisions. Do you rely on science and research? Do you rely on expertise and practitioners? Where do we make the value judgment in those? So without further ado, enjoy. All right, today we are joined by a very special guest, the new author of the book, The Hot Hand, The Mystery and Science of Streaks, Ben Cohen. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So we're really excited about this, mainly because, Ben, you know, I read your book and that's why I had to reach out because it combines all of my loves, which is a little bit of storytelling, a good deal of science and sports.
Those are three things that I really like too. I thought you were going to say that, like, you know, NBA Jam and farming and Van Gogh or something, but I'm glad to hear, you know, sports science and stats and data.
Well, I grew up on NBA Jam, so I loved every minute of that. I was like, he's on fire. I could just hear it like ringing in my ears every time I read it. I was like, oh yeah, this was basically all my adolescence in the 90s.
Yeah, imagine writing a whole chapter about it if you think it's ringing in your ears after reading it. My God, it's like permanently burned into my ears right now.
Yes.
So let's maybe lay the foundation for our audience a little bit. The Hot Hand, most of us, you know, you just mentioned NBA Jam. Most of us think about it in the basketball terms. He's on fire, all that stuff. How does this, you know, your book expands to including the science of streaks. How does this kind of expand to beyond just the basketball realm?
Yeah, I think that is sort of the reason why I wrote the book. I mean, this is the hot hand is this phenomenon that has been studied by really brilliant economists and psychologists and statisticians for about 35 years now. And it's an idea that has always been rooted in basketball. And yet that's not the reason why these brilliant minds were studying it. Like they liked basketball, but they didn't really care all that much about basketball. They cared about human behavior. And it turns out that this basketball phenomenon happens to be this really wonderful excuse to explore the rest of the world. And so that's why this book is so wide-ranging, is because like all of these brilliant guys who studied the hot hand kind of gave me an excuse to do that. Like it would have been intellectually dishonest to not write about basketball. But it also would have been intellectually dishonest to only write about basketball. And that's kind of where the book starts, and it goes in many, many different directions from there.
Yeah, that's part of the reason why I loved it is the connections. In a lot of ways, it kind of reminds me of David Epstein's book Range, which brings a lot of different concepts together and then also talks about the benefits of having this diverse thinking, so where you can translate lessons from one area to the other. And I think, you know, as I was reading The Hot Hand, like all I kept doing is having these aha moments of like, oh, of course this applies over there, even though I've never thought about it in that direction. So how, like, as a fellow writer, I'm very curious, like, how you decided to, or how you figured out to branch out to all these different avenues.
That is something that I'm still trying to figure out for myself. By the way, that's a very generous compliment to the David Epstein book. I wish that I were as like good and graceful a runner as he was as well. But I don't think I'll be there for quite some time. But the finding the stories and figuring out how all of these pieces connected was to me the greatest challenge in writing the book. It also happened to be the most rewarding part of writing the book, because you know I write about sports for the Wall Street Journal, and you know mostly I write about the NBA. I don't really get the chance to visit sugar beet farms in Minnesota when I'm writing about, you know, LeBron James and Steph Curry, and so I knew I wanted to do that. And you know, the problem with being able to write about anything is that what you do write about has to clear this really high bar. It has to be compelling to a lot of people. And I have some experience with that writing for the journal, because I write about sports and it has to be interesting to people who know everything about sports and also nothing about sports. And it has to really thread that needle. And I kind of kept that in mind while writing this book. But the whole point of the book was to apply this idea very, very widely and to explore every angle of this phenomenon through human stories. I wanted to put human faces on this idea of the hot hand, and I knew it had to go in just wild directions. And so, you know, there was clearly going to be a lot of basketball, but like there's also Shakespeare and there's the Princess Bride and the Holocaust. I mean, it kind of went everywhere. And, you know, from the very beginning, one of the first things that my editor told me when I was writing the book was that while writing, the cool thing of writing a book, Steve, maybe you know this, is that like you start to see these patterns, these connections form when you're thinking about this idea and you have it in the back of your mind for so long. And hopefully there were some of those aha moments and epiphanies in the book for readers. I know there certainly was for me as the writer.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about writing. And I think that, you know, that skill or that ability of once you dive deep on something and like have the ability to see these different connections and patterns, that goes beyond just writing. Like, I think that is a fundamental skill for any coaches too, right?
That's interesting though. But you know, obviously one of the themes or takeaways from this book is like the great lesson of the hot hand, which is that sometimes we see patterns where they don't exist, right? And So there was this weird like irony and almost like meta aspect to me while writing the book, which is that the reason why that first seminal paper about the hot hand in 1985 was published, the reason it was it was such a big deal was its counterintuitive conclusion, which is that there is no such thing as the hot hand. It's simply this cognitive bias, this very easily digestible example of seeing patterns and randomness where they don't exist and inventing causes to explain them. It was basically our minds playing tricks on us. And so, you know, while I was writing this book and thinking about patterns and randomness and how they interact with each other at all times, and really how our minds work, I was also like seeing these patterns in the book. It was this very strange phenomenon. And I kind of was like, am I doing exactly what I should not be doing right now?
But that gets to the heart of it though, because that's like, to me, that's the heart of your book. There is almost this like, how do we distinguish and how do we decide what is almost real and not real, right? What is our framework for making that decision? And I think the heart of your book is almost this back and forth of, we'll call it science or research versus like these expert practitioners that are telling you their experiences and what they feel and how to decide or make that interplay work.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. That question of how much we should trust what we see and feel, I think, is really the key tension in the whole book. And you know, the really tricky thing about that, I mean, that's like, it's sort of like this question of the human condition anyway, right? Like, it's something that we are always trying to grapple to figure out. But in this case of the hot hand, what we see and feel and what the best data and best evidence suggests has changed a lot over the years, right? I mean, over the last 35 years, we've gone from something that we all thought to be true, only to be told that it wasn't, only to realize that maybe it actually was. And really, it depends on the circumstance, and it depends on the environment and the conditions that you are in. I mean, I think that's really the fun of thinking about the hot hand and toying around with this idea for yourself, is that like really smart people for a really long time have thought about this and they have come to different conclusions. And I think like that's totally fine. And I think that like there are industries where it does exist and there are also industries where it does not exist. And like the real thrill for me in thinking about the hot hand for like the last 4 or 5 years is trying to figure that out for myself, like in my daily life, right?
Yeah, Ben, that's, I mean, there's a lot of things that are paradoxical and, you know, ironic in your book. But one thing I wanted to like really unpack with you that I found a very interesting, you know, thought was that talent is important, but circumstance is imperative, and the circumstance beats talent when talent doesn't have circumstance. And, you know, as coaches, we often deal with this concept of talent and, you know, nature versus nurture. And I thought that was a really interesting point. And for when I read it, and I just would like you to expand on that a little bit, and maybe even to anchor it in kind of all your observations and writings about the NBA, specifically as it relates to sport, where we have this idea where talent is just going to rise to the top, but there's a lot of like roll the dice and lucks and twists and turns that need to happen. So yeah, I'm just more interested in that little quote and you unpacking that a little bit more for us.
Sure. I thought I was like bastardizing John Wooden a little bit there. There's something like Wooden-esque about that, that formation, I think. But I think it's totally true. And I think to me, the hot hand is this collision of talent and circumstance and a little bit of luck thrown in. And I think the interesting thing about circumstance is that sometimes it presents itself when you least expect it. And so, you know, the first chapter of this book is about Steph Curry, and it's about the hottest game of his life and the greatest streak that he was ever on. And it was this game against the New York Knicks in Madison Square Garden in February 2013. He scored 54 points. He made 11 of his 13 three-pointers. To this day, he says it's the hottest that he's ever been. And it was kind of the game that changed his life and the fate of the Golden State Warriors and the future of the entire NBA. And yet, when that game started, if you were to ask Steph Curry, is this going to be the game that changes your life? He would have not only said no, he would have looked at you like you had nine heads. Because what happened the night before was that the Golden State Warriors had this game in Indiana. They got into a fight. Steph was actually involved in the fight. And if you go back and watch some of the footage, he probably should have been suspended. The only reason he wasn't was that he was not big enough to do any damage in a fight of NBA players. And so he sort of gets tossed to the side, like Roy Hibbert, this 7'2" giant, just flicks him away like he's a mosquito, basically. And they fly to New York that morning. He is fined $35,000 instead of being suspended. Some of his teammates were suspended, but he only gets fined. And you know, nobody in the history of basketball has ever been so fortunate to lose so much money, because the Warriors needed scoring that night. They only had like 7 or 8 players, and they needed like everything that they could get from Steph Curry. So he ends up playing 48 minutes that night. He doesn't come out of the game, which is astonishing given what we know about load management like 7, 8 years later. But the other reason why you would never have expected this game to be the game that changed everything for him was that his routine was off. Steph Curry always takes the second bus from the Warriors team hotel on road games. On this day, for some reason that he can't remember, he takes the third bus. He misses the second bus and he's stuck taking the third bus. The third bus pulls out of their hotel downtown in New York and gets pulled over by the New York City cops. So not only is he late, not only has he taken the wrong bus, not only is he $35,000 poorer, but he's like stuck dealing with the cops, and like his warm-up routine is rushed, everything is off, and then he has the game of his life. And so that to me was this very neat example of circumstance and talent. Like Steph Curry would never have thought that that would be the circumstance that changed everything, and yet it was. And clearly he had the talent, right? Like, you know, and I think there's a difference between like some terrible basketball player like me getting hot in like a JV basketball game and Steph Curry getting hot in Madison Square Garden. Like, one has long-term effects and the other is just this nice memory that you know, one of us has for the rest of our lives. And so I think that, like, you know, you can really get hot, and there's a power and a force behind the hot hand when you combine that talent and that circumstance. And sometimes, like, circumstance doesn't present itself, and that's when, like, it's kind of depressing, right? And sometimes yes. circumstance does, and you don't have the talent, you're not Steph Curry. So I think you need that, like, marriage of the two, if that makes any sense.
No, totally. I think, you know, it was interesting too. You know, a lot of people hear this stuff and go, how do we doctor it? How do we, you know, manufacture it? How do we make it so people can get the hot hand, you know, in competition or in life? And, you know, the ironic thing is, it's kind of like when you think about it at the two higher levels of simple heat and complex heat, that was posed in one of the research studies that you cited. I think that makes sense. Like, we have simple heat, which is a little bit more shallow and superficial, but complex heat, like you're talking about with Steph Curry, where he goes on fire and then on, you know, that game against the Knicks and changes the complexion of not only his career, the Warriors, and potentially the NBA's, is something that you can't really manufacture or doctor. And like Steph Curry, you even quoted him as saying, like, once it happens, you just have to embrace it. You have to go with it. And I think that's where we as coaches and athletes are curious, you know, just from your perspective, you know, how do you create, or at least create a, that concept of gravity that you talked about a little bit, that NBA players talk about, like, and make it so that those circumstances allow for a higher probability of gravity to occur versus having it just be roll the dice in a walk of randomness and luck of the draw.
Yeah, John, I think you've managed to hit on, like, the essential mystery of the hot hand, which is how do we put ourselves in this position to get hot? And, you know, this is one of the first questions that I had when writing the book, and I figured who better to ask than the greatest shooter in the history of the planet. And so I asked Steph about this when we were talking about that game. I said, like, do you ever know when you're about to get hot? And what he said right. is that he doesn't know when it's going to happen or where or how or why it's going to happen. But once it does happen, you have to embrace it. And I think, you know, that's the best way to think about it. Once it does happen, you have to embrace it, and you have to sort of be in that position where you can embrace it. And so I wish I knew how to, like, get hot at work, or, like, have pages of words and sentences come flowing out of me, but I can't. I mean, the only thing you can do is try to take advantage of that moment when it presents itself, because the one thing that we do know for sure about the hot hand is that it does not last forever. And so we all try to bottle that magical feeling because we know it's going to run out, and we want to capitalize on it while we can.
Yeah, it was interesting too. The, you know, that's exactly kind of the takeaway I had. But then when in the subsequent chapters, you talked about Shakespeare and how Shakespeare and this idea of clumping, right? And clumping is very natural. We see clumping, you know, in nature with, like, clumps of fruit on a tree, or people like Shakespeare or Van Gogh go through these hot streaks and these spurts, or Einstein, right? And I think sometimes we get this idea because now we have, say, agriculture and farming, that we can, you know, create the circumstance or create the conditions to line up all these orange trees or line up all these ears of corn, that it in nature, naturally, it just happens on its own in these little clusters. And so, you know, again, that idea of clumping, you know, what was your takeaway when you discovered that natural truth being expressed again and again and again, and then how, you know, we can have a better sense of having that awareness that when that clump happens of, or that streak happens, and going with it? Because it seemed time and time again, Shakespeare, Van Gogh, Steph Curry, none of them were aware they're in this, going to enter this hot streak. If anything, conditions were actually really shitty. Shakespeare had the plague, you know, before he wrote King Lear. Van Gogh, like, went to this really crappy place in the south of France that was cold, windy, and not idealistic. Steph Curry was
yeah,
fine.
South of France sounds terrible, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So it's like, but yet all those, you know, time and time again, you see that pattern where it's like these clumps of some of the most brilliant work that these artists, whether it's Steph Curry, to Van Gogh, or Shakespeare, created was in this period when it's like, oh crap, conditions are not ideal. And then all of a sudden, boom, this explosion of creativity and their best work. And I kind of think about right now of the state we're in with, you know, dealing with this global emergency crisis and pandemic, you know, it's like conditions are not ideal for a lot of things, but perhaps out of this, we might see some amazing creative work be born.
Yeah, so I think there are two things here. The first is this phenomenon of clumping is really fascinating. And, you know, David Epstein did a really wonderful job of writing about clumping in his books. To me, the reason clumping is so important when thinking about the hot hand is because when writing this book, I knew I wanted to figure out why do we believe in the hot hand? And it turns out like this is a belief that has been evolutionarily ingrained into us. There were rewards for believing in the hot hand. Like if you study the hot hand in monkeys or even in primitive humans, as evolutionary psychologists have done, they also believe in the hot hand. And it's because nature is clumpy, right? Like when we were foraging, when we were hunting and gathering, like there were actual rewards for looking for patterns because it turns out that's where food was, right? And so this is not like a bug of the human brain. It's actually a feature. And that was really fascinating to me. And then when we get into like the creativity and productivity and the science of streaks in your career, I think that's what we were talking about with Shakespeare and with Van Gogh and with Rob Reiner, right? I mean, what some researchers have found in very recent years is that we all have these hot hand periods in our careers. So this is not just a matter of like Steph Curry getting hot over the course of 48 minutes in one basketball game. It is that there are times in our careers when we elevate, when we transcend our own abilities and we create our best work. And what these scientists have found is that our best work comes in bunches. Our creative hits are clustered. And that is, to me, what was so interesting about Shakespeare. Because like, yes, this talent and circumstance collided in a very strange way. Like the plague was actually Shakespeare's secret weapon. But like the fascinating thing is that we all have a bit of Shakespeare in us, I think. I mean, what these scientists have found, this statistical physicist at Northwestern named Dashen Wang, is that you know, there are these hot hand periods that tend to define our careers. They are what we remember, and they are what people remember about us. And he went looking for this in movie directors and scientists and artists, and he found these objective measures of putting numbers on the subjective. So for movies, he found IMDb ratings. For scientists, he found Google Scholar citations. For artists, auction prices. I mean, not perfect measures, but basically the best ways of quantifying taste and quality and achievement that he could find. And what he thinks is that if he were to look at any industry, he would find the same thing, that this is really a universal phenomenon. And that's why I think like Shakespeare and Van Gogh and Steph Curry are all connected in this odd way. Like these hot hand periods are what we remember about them, whether it's 8 years later or 400 years later, right?
Yeah. What I love about one of the quotes in there that I loved by Wang was that the only way to prevent hot hands is to stop publishing. And I think that's such a powerful message for people to understand, because I think we have this idea that, you know, our best periods of work, whether it's in our field coaching runners or running, like has to occur during a certain period of times. But we never know when that hot hand period can come. And then,
yeah, it's a very optimistic view. And it turns out, like, I think what is really uplifting about it is that what you think of as your hot hand period now might not be, right? I mean, there might be a hotter period on the horizon. So you never quite know when it's past or when it's in the future. Now, maybe that's naive, but I like to think of it as more optimistic than anything. And I think, like, if Steph Curry had thought, like, in 2013, well, like, this is it for me. I've gotten hot and that's it. Like we wouldn't have had the last like seven magical years of his career. So that to me was also one of the more powerful messages of this whole thing, is that like the only way to figure it out is to keep going.
Yeah. And one of the other sections that I really loved when you're talking about messages and lessons was from Nick Hager, who is a farmer. And I just loved, I think this is the best advice, whatever you're doing when you're in our field of coaching, is it fits perfectly. But you summed up the chapter on him, and I'm going to give this away because I think it's gold, is play defense, remember the long game, control what you can control, prepare for the worst and hope for anything remotely better, always stick to principles over patterns. And I love, you know, that's a lot of advice right there, but I'd love to unpack, or love for you to unpack a little bit about of that and maybe what you learned from Nick.
Yeah, that's just me stealing from Nick basically directly, and Nick sort of stealing from his five generations of ancestors before him. So Nick is this brilliant sugar beet farmer on the border of Minnesota and North Dakota. And his family has been there for about 150 years now, I think. And he did not think he was going to enter the family business when he was growing up on the farm. He was this incredible trombonist. He actually went to Juilliard to train in trombone and figured he would play in some orchestra somewhere. He ended up going back to the farm and realized very quickly that he needed to learn like the lessons of the family business. He went through this farming education, and those lessons that he learned were really what you just said, Steve. I mean, those play defense, right? I mean, that's the difference between farming and playing basketball, is that one is more about offense. The other is about defense. And really the difference there to me, the crucial distinction, is the one of control. In basketball, you have agency. You have control over your own situation. But what Nick discovered in farming is that you really don't. Like, the single biggest determinant of a good year in farming is the weather. Like, as it's as random as the weather. And so he is at the mercy of chance. All he can do is everything in his power, while understanding that he really does not have all that much power. Play the long game. Like, one good year or one bad year is not everything when you are thinking about a 150, 200 year business. But most important, trust principles instead of chasing patterns. So Nick is like a huge sports fan. He believes in the hot hand in basketball, but he can't behave as if he believes in the hot hand in farming. Because if he does, if he bets his farm on, like, you know, soybeans having a good year because they had a good year last year, he can lose everything. And to me, those stakes were so high. Like, if Steph Curry takes like a 30-foot shot because he feels hot, what are the stakes? He misses one shot. It's not that big of a deal, right? But if you like plow your entire fortune or all of your business into one patch of farmland because it happened to perform well the 2 years before, and it's a year when it doesn't perform well, that can be disastrous, right? It's why the hot hand can be this costly illusion, as the psychologist who wrote about it wrote. I mean, it can really backfire and it can burn you. And so what he's learned is that he has to not believe in the hot hand, or not behave as if he believes in the hot hand in farming. And, you know, to me, farming is more like investing, right, than it is like playing sports. You have to realize what you can control and what you can't. And there's a difference between skilled performance and random performance. And I thought Nick was just was so delightful and so just smart about explaining that and understanding his own industry.
Yeah, Nick really crystallized for me the micro versus macro. So on the micro level, the hot hand is very real, and we can be streaky, and we can have like this good fortunate circumstance in a 48, quote unquote, 48 minute basketball game, or a couple months of or years of really high and creative productivity. But on a macro level, scaling out, like, the pattern of the hot hand, right? You can't bank on it. You have to go with these tried and true principles. And I think that's the same thing for a lot of coaches, is we tend to look at from a micro level, who's having the most success this season? Who's bringing something that's, you know, new and exciting, or, oh my gosh, this is the new thing, or that's a new thing, or this person's or this group's being really successful. And then we have this copycat mimicry bias in us. And so we just mimic that. And we say, okay, this is what works, and it's working now. But it's very short term, because it might just be streaky. It might just be that perfect meeting of talent and circumstance for a very short period of time. Steve and I are big, you know, running dork and history buffs. And we scale out and we look at kind of these principles, tried and true, over the course of decades, if not centuries, of what worked for coaching of runners or training of runners. There starts to be a lot of similarities. I wouldn't say patterns. I just say similarities in principles that you can kind of, you know, bank on and take home, that in order to prepare for the crucible that is competition in the running world or in life, you need to have a certain amount of preparation of a certain type of work. And I think Nick's juxtaposing Nick's reality with also the concept of like this idea of the NBA Jam. You're on fire. You're heating up. You can gamify this a little bit. Is the truth that we have to hold in our heads is a paradox, kind of like, you know, with Steve and Brad's books, this concept of like, we need to understand, yeah, we think we can gamify it in the short term and heat up and get on fire, but long term, we just can't make those big investments and run to the bank. Where else, you know, Ben, have you seen that played out, or have you seen this concept of people mismanaging or misinterpreting the micro, the short term, and have it being catastrophic or not really being of benefit to kind of their long-term strategy?
Well, I think that like investing in money management is a clear one, but you know, I think probably, which we're all figuring out now, but I think that actually the more interesting one, the one that I think I'd like to talk about since we haven't talked about, is sort of the corollary to the hot hand, which is this idea called the gambler's fallacy. I'll explain that one through basketball, because everything in this book comes back to basketball, whether I like it or not. In basketball, if you go into an arena and you see Steph Curry make three shots in a row, everybody in that arena thinks that he's making a fourth shot. That's the hot hand. If you walk into a casino, however, and you walk over to the roulette wheel and you see the wheel land on red three times in a row, what research has actually shown is that most people will bet on black the next time. That's fascinating, right? I mean, that's This is the same situation. Three things happen, and yet we come to completely different conclusions. For one, we bet on the streak to continue, and the other, we bet on the streak to end. The second one is the gambler's fallacy. And like, the gambler's fallacy is interesting to me because it's not just about what happens in Las Vegas. Like, that is actually the least interesting thing about it. What researchers have shown is that the gambler's fallacy affects our decision making. I mean, that's really why these psychologists and economists have looked at the hot hand and the gambler's fallacy for all these years, is because it's really about judgment and decision making. And you know, when a bunch of economists studied loan officers and baseball umpires and asylum judges, I mean, people with real authority who control the fates of other people in their own hands, when they looked at the decisions that they made, they found that even they are subject to the gambler's fallacy, that they are prone to this really important and at times dangerous bias. And so in baseball, it means that like umpires will, after calling two close strikes in a row, if they see a third pitch that's really close, they're more likely to call it a ball that time. Now, that's a trivial example, but you know, asylum judges, if they have granted asylum to two or three refugees in a row, they are much less likely to grant asylum to a fourth refugee, regardless of the merits of the case. Now, that's not trivial. That's actually really crushing and demoralizing, and it shows how powerful these biases are, and that even people whose jobs it is to literally judge. I mean, these people are called judges, right? Like, they're supposed to be making impartial, bias-free judgments. Even they are prone to seeing patterns where they don't exist and trying to balance out the streak in their own mind. So I think like whether it's baseball umpires or asylum judges or coaches or writers or anything, like we need to just sort of be on the lookout for these biases constantly and try to correct for them in our own minds.
So at the end, when you're kind of concluding things up, you kind of hinted at that and ways to do that almost. And one of the sections or passages that I highlighted that I think gets to this is that after going through some of those things, you said, but if they had started from scratch, there would have been no prior assumptions for them to overturn. The experts would have looked at the painting this you're talking about identifying of Van Gogh and seen the truth staring them in the face the whole time. Now, how, you know, in that passage, you talk about starting from scratch. How do we know, or how do we develop that mindset to be able to almost ditch some of our assumptions and see things from a new perspective to maybe keep us from falling for some of these biases?
Oh my God, what a fantastic question. I wish I had a better answer. This is talking about this Van Gogh painting that for many, many years had been assumed to not be a real Van Gogh painting. It had been hiding in someone's attic for 100 years. And yet when Van Gogh scholars looked at it 100 years later without any preconceived notions, they were able to see what everybody had missed that whole time. They were able to look at this very old problem in a new light. And so how do we do that? I think it's important to get fresh eyes on things at all times. I mean, that's hard when you are in the same industry doing the same job, but it's why, like, you know, at newspapers, reporters change beats a lot, because eventually, like, if you cover the NBA for 5 years, you don't see things that people, you know, strangers, people with fresh eyes will see. It's like, this might sound odd, but like whenever my wife, for example, or my parents watch an NBA game and come to me with some sort of just peculiar observation, I always pay attention, because it's like, this is what people who are not used to watching like 5 NBA games every night are seeing. And that's really important to me. And I'm sure that, like, people, you know, it sort of goes back to that idea of having diverse experiences and being able to call on different experts to solve different problems. And so, I don't know exactly how that applies to every industry, but I think it's really important to keep in mind. Sometimes solutions come from very odd places.
No, sorry, John. I just want to add to that.
Go ahead, Steve.
I love that answer, even though you downplayed it at the beginning, because that's been my experience in coaching. And that's why I think, like, or in any field, we think the path is towards deeper and deeper and deeper into expertise. But sometimes it's adding breadth or going wider to see what people and experts far outside of your field are doing. I was fortunate enough to take a brief foray into the NBA for some unknown reason when all that fatigue and load management came into place, because people are asking me, well, like, how do you deal with fatigue? And I'm like, oh yeah, fatigue, that's easy. Like, that's all we deal with in distance running.
Yeah.
But like, sitting here listening to you think, it's like, of course there are different sports and different areas that are going to see things from different perspectives. So I think, you know, one of the reasons, and you follow the NBA better than, you know, either of us, obviously, one of the reasons you're starting to see these explosions, whether it's in at first analytics and now fatigue and maybe into some cognitive psychology stuff in sports like the NBA, is because you're getting people from the outside who aren't lifers in there that might see some things that those trapped in the expertise don't.
I think that's all true and totally fair. And yet, I also think one of the lessons of this book is that it's worth listening to the experts too, right? Sometimes practitioners have knowledge that outsiders simply don't. And so when basketball players swear the hot hand is real, it's worth listening to them as well. So I think that, like, it's worth keeping both of those perspectives in mind and balancing the two of them, like challenging our long-held assumptions, but also listening to people who might know what they're talking about.
Yeah, it's almost like that interplay, because you almost see this pendulum swing back and forth. And I think you saw that in baseball, particularly with, like, Moneyball era, et cetera, et cetera. And we swung heavily in one direction. And then actually mentioned in your book with Bill James was quoted as like, hey, wait a minute, not all of these things that we're saying based on analytics might be true, right?
Yeah, it turns out nuance is important. And, like, you know, black and white thinking might not be the best. It's, you know, there are shades of gray, and it's important to think about those things. So, like, when even Bill James is doubling back on himself and, like, doing the most counterintuitive, contrarian thing he can do, which is Bill James questioning some sabermetric truth, right? Like, I think that's a really powerful lesson, is that, like, we can all afford to do this. So, you know, maybe, I think that this book strikes an interesting tone of, I think when you read it, you are encouraged to think about the idea for yourself and try to figure out what you think about it. I don't think that like you can come away from this book thinking there is definitely such a thing as the hot hand or there is no such thing as the hot hand. But, you know, if there were, I mean, probably the Bill James equivalent would be like writing a whole book saying the hot hand doesn't exist and then writing another book 5 years later saying that actually maybe it does exist, right? I mean, it's sort of changing our minds is not a bad thing. It's actually probably something that we should encourage more.
Yeah, Ben, I think what I walked away from this book was realizing how important what I call three-dimensional thinking is. And I think that's what we're alluding to right now. I mean, we have that one-dimensional thinking, things are, you know, binary, black or white. And then we have two-dimensional thinking, which is a, you know, expert or specialist gets a little bit of generality and then starts to think in like, okay, well, maybe there's some gray. The third dimension, and I think that's the hardest, and that's where we see a lot of people who are pioneers or who change the industry or backtrack. So Bill James, or even, you know, at the end of the book, when Daniel Kahneman is at that lecture at Columbia University, you know, and says, well, yeah, the original paper was wrong. The authors were biased because the data was biased, et cetera, et cetera. You know, those show me very poignantly that we always have to keep rapidly evolving and changing based on better data. And I think you referenced that early in the book too, where, you know, it's about finding the better data, not more data, but better. And I think that's where the search for being a three-dimensional thinker lies is, yes, we must trust the experts because they know those things. And we must trust more than anything the three-dimensional experts who understand that more data or better data might come into their purview, which might reorient or reshape their thinking. And so we too must evolve and be open to, you know, a change in the weather. And I'm curious for you, like in the process of, you know, unpacking, researching and writing this book, how has your own like thought process or interpretation of things changed like before you started and to today talking to us on this podcast?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I think you're precisely right about what you said first. I mean, Andrew Gelman, this wonderful statistician at Columbia, he put it this way. I just pulled up this page in the book where he says, when we see holes in our theories or contradictions or anomalies, we should be bothered by these things rather than trying to explain them away. And Andrew Gelman believes like the capacity of discomfort is actually the mark of an honest scientist, that like even people who have reached the top of their profession should seek out challenges to their own beliefs, and they should be willing to change their minds. And when we talk about better data, I think it's important to point out that like this 1985 paper that is really one of these classic papers in the canon of behavioral economics, it was based on the best data available at the time. I mean, that data now looks sort of primitive, but one of the things that made it such a sensation of a paper is that the data it was based on, like, there was nothing like it at the time. And yet, like, the data in 2014 was much better than it was in 1985. And the data in 2020 is much better than it was in 2014. And I think that's why this debate about the hot hand is continuing to heat up, because, like, there will always be better data and it will tell us things that it hasn't said before. Now, in terms of my own thinking, especially about this book, I went in not really knowing what to expect. I had read the three like big papers, but I didn't know if one of them was more right than the other. And I think that the most challenging thing in writing this book and thinking about those ideas was balancing them and trying to figure out what I thought about this idea for myself. And so when Danny Kahneman is at Columbia saying, well, yes, like maybe the original paper was biased because the test was biased, like that's one thing. But what he says next is actually equally interesting, which is that the underlying lesson of that paper still applies, which is that we see patterns where they don't exist, and you can balance those two ideas at once. And so even if there is such a thing as the hot hand, which I believe and which I think I have always believed, maybe it's not like the exaggerated fireball in our imaginations from playing NBA Jam. And so I do think that 3D thinking that you referred to, that's sort of where I came away from this book, is that like, it's not, the question is not, is there such a thing as the hot hand? It's, well, when is there such a thing, and why, and how can we take advantage? And that's sort of what I want readers to come away from this book thinking.
Yeah, one key thing you said about the hot hand early on, when, you know, talking about Steph Curry, is it's a sense of gravity, right? Where the athlete or the person who's experiencing it and cognizant of it gains more confidence. But then it's a fine line between confidence and arrogance, right? And I think in everyday life, since we might not be like on a court or in a race, you know, what are some kind of key markers that you found, you know, through your research and thinking about this, where that confidence, where things are going your way, tips over into arrogance and actually becomes more of an obstacle rather than an asset in that person's path?
Oh, yeah. So these are called heat checks in basketball, right? When you feel like you can take a crazier shot, a longer shot, a riskier shot because you've made a few shots in a row and you know you have this license to do anything, like take shots that would ordinarily earn you this permanent spot at the end of the bench, you can throw up and nobody will fault you. And so in the book, I mostly write about heat checks in a positive way and show how they can kind of elevate your career and change your life a little bit. Whether it's you are Steph Curry taking a shot or you are the movie director Rob Reiner and you are using your hot hand to make a movie that nobody wants you to make. Now, as you point out, there's definitely a flip side to that. I didn't explore it as much, but when you do take that heat check, like, you better be sure you are right, because like sometimes people don't want you to do things because you shouldn't be doing them, right? It's not because the world hasn't caught up to your way of thinking. It's because they actually have, and they understand that it's perilous. And so I think keeping that in mind is super important. Like, you know, I sometimes confidence does become arrogance, and sometimes thinking like, oh yeah, keep going, your hot hand is on the horizon, sometimes that's kind of foolish, right? Like, the circumstances will not align and you could spend your entire life chasing this hot hand that will never come to fruition. And so I just think, again, like, that's part of the fun and the mystery of thinking about this and trying to figure out, like, I think in the book I use this metaphor of the 3-point line as like, that's kind of what made Steph Curry into Steph Curry. Like, if there is no 3-point line, the ability to shoot the basketball from far distances and only have it worth 2 points is like wasted. Like, of course you want to get near the basket. That gives you a better shot at getting 2 points. So I think we all have to look for these 3-point lines in our own lives and see where they exist and where they don't exist and where, you know, these little strips of tape can change everything.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, you talk about confidence in there and heat checks and all that. And it's interesting because, like, my mind when I read that went up to, okay, increased risk taking with confidence makes sense. And because I'm a science nerd, I went and read up on this a little bit. And it's interesting. There's some studies that show that the confidence translating to risk taking is different among, we'll say, elite or well-trained athletes versus your amateur athletes, where elite athletes tend to take, we'll say, better calculated risks, and our amateur athletes tend to just take risks. So the example in running that was given in one of these is, like, elite athletes will take the risk to run within maybe their capacities, but at the upper bounds of it, where an amateur athlete will, say, in a marathon, will take up far, will feel good, go off too far too fast, and then suffer the consequences. So I think that gets back to this idea of a hot hand, increased confidence can be great, but it's like knowing and having the self-awareness to understand, like, when that is pushing you too far and when it isn't. And I think the elite athletes, just through training practice, tend to have figured that out much better than the rest of us on some occasions.
Have you guys found that in your own coaching?
100%. I mean, I have. Again, it depends on the athlete a little bit, but, like, the more experienced ones who have tried and we'll call it failed and have learned from that, like, understand risk taking better. And the great thing about running is you can kind of calculate this by looking at their pacing of events. And there's,
oh, that's true. That's interesting.
Yeah, there's some great data, actually, if you look at it, where they look at pacing of young kids, like elementary school kids doing the physical fitness PE mile test, right, that we all did when we were young. Well, young kids, what do they do when they pace? They go out really hard, they sprint off the line, and then they slow down to a jog or a walk, and then they sprint at the end, right? There's this wide variation. And then as you look at, as you get into high school, college, professional, that variation decreases to a very, very small amount of variation for the most part in runners. And one of the reasons is that is because researchers think that athletes get a better template between their mismatch of like effort they're giving and the demand of the activity. And so
they have a deeper knowledge base, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, it's easy to understand that in coaching and running and stuff. But I, you know, when I read that in yours, I'm like, oh, this probably applies to much more than our little tiny sport.
Okay, I'm turning the tables here and just asking you guys questions. How does this apply to like the 1500, where it's not just about like how fast you can run, but there's like this deep strategy that goes into every race too?
So I'll answer this, and then John, you can add on to it. I think it applies in two ways. So one is there's this concept of a hot hand on a global or a wider scale, which you can get hot from, we'll say, practice to practice, race to race, where people just get in on a roll, everything's clicking, and all of a sudden, if you're racing every week, like time drops. And I think that is a great example of this confidence tying into allowing you to perform to your ability. And then on a like smaller scale, so like in a 1500 in a race, when I think of this, I think of this as when you get in a race, let's say 1500, you get to 800 meters, and all of a sudden you get to 800 meters a little faster than expected, and you feel a little bit better than expected, and that confidence starts to roll, right? And all of a sudden you start saying, hey, I can do this, I can keep going, all that stuff. That's where I think our version of this hot hand is when we feel better than expected running faster than we are. Now the key there to me as a coach is knowing when that data, that feedback is real and when it might be leading you down a place where you're going to blow up in the last lap or in the last little bit. What do you think, John?
You know, I go back to a quote you said, you know, in your book, where musicians had to be optimists and farmers had to be realists. And the reality is athletes have to be optimists and coaches have to be realists. And we have to, as coaches, be anchored in, you know, things that are a little bit more concrete, like the data. So in running, right, there's all these like behavioral things that are really important. And like Steve said, influences us in the moment. And as you have a deeper knowledge base or more experience, you have a better filter about what is the likelihood or probability that you can continue on at this pace or can make a surge and be able to buffer the injection of that speed into your ability to sustain for the duration of the rest of the event. And what I've found is, you know, the key to running faster is very simple. It's the athlete whose foot is on the ground for less time is the faster athlete over the course of a race. Now, like Steve said, if you're a young or inexperienced athlete and you go out faster pace early on and you're not prepared to sustain that for whatever duration it is, a marathon or a mile, your foot's going to be on the ground longer in the latter stages of the race. And that can be exponentially longer, right? So what I've done is just really kind of callous my athletes who I work with to be like, look, the goal is to have minimal ground contact time, because when you're in air flying, that's where we're actually the propulsion is to move forward. So what we have to understand is you can have this optimistic view that you get through 800 meters faster than expected and be excited and ready to go. But if you can't sustain that velocity because you don't have the mechanics or the strength or even the physiological capacity to sustain that turnover, as we call it in running, it doesn't matter, right? So we are constantly like in this seesaw, I think, between what is optimistic thinking and what is realistic thinking. And that's where athlete and coach have to work in concert to be able to create a language and a mental model, and then also a plan of action for different scenarios. Now, as we're seeing today in the world, but also as we see as athletes and coaches and, you know, even spectators of sports, you know, very few plans, no plan survives in contact with the enemy, which means we're trying to create structure and chaos. And that's where this concept of behavioral thinking of that is so prevalent throughout, and you know, the kind of the red thread through the hot hand is really interesting to me, because we have to be able to interpret on the fly these different inputs, whether it's feeling, sensation, time, etc. And then the athlete has to make, without timeouts and running, right? We can't like say, okay, hey, timeout, you're not going that fast. Let's take a breather and get in, you know, and kind of get sorted back out and have a little bit of a powwow here with a 20-second timeout like you can in basketball. The athlete's on their own, right? You can yell something to them maybe when they come around, but where they hear it and process it with all the other inputs, you never know, right? I've had athletes who like never hear me, and like I'm 2 feet away from them. Like I didn't even hear you once, coach. I yelled every time 25 laps, and you didn't hear me once. So what we have to understand too in running is it's different, because there's a you start and then you don't get any stopping periods, right? Like you do in a lot of other sports, and I think that's what puts the onus so much more on preparation. But two, what we're also starting to see is, this is another tangent of a thought, is the culture of running has become this one of massive amounts of preparation and not a whole lot of actual competition. And it's trickling down to the college and the high school ranks. So now what's happening is, like in basketball, right? They're actually playing more games in high school, right? They're playing more showcases. They're playing more. So they're getting a deeper knowledge base with more competition and different variances of exposures. In running, we are doctoring and creating this controlled circumstance and environment. And then we throw athletes into very few racing opportunities because it's deemed bad for training or bad for physiological robustness to race now. And what's happening though is behaviorally, athletes are getting worse, even though their time's getting faster, meaning they're worse competitors in very novel circumstances, which are championship races that usually go out slow or have a wide pace variance where there's no rabbit. But in very predictable circumstances, time trial races, which mimic a lot of the practice they do, these athletes can run very fast on the on our time-based scale, but actually not get anything out of it from a competitive base. And so,
are there exceptions to that on the world stage?
I mean, it's systemic now. We're seeing at the high school level more than ever. So now we're seeing this graduation of athletes who ran a lot faster than Steve and I did when we were in high school or when you were in high school. But now they're burning out sooner because they're not being competitive. They're not actually getting the accolades or the positive reinforcement at the collegiate and even the post-collegiate level of them being esteemed by whatever metrics, whether it's social media, whether it's media, me in general, or whether it's even getting a contract or retaining a contract and a sponsor, because their orientation was, I ran fast, but I got 14th at this really special invite, but I broke 9 minutes for 3200, which was used to be a barrier for high school athletes, like 4 minutes for a mile used to be a barrier. But they got 14th in the race. They ran 8:56. They go to this, you know, good running school that has a lot of circumstances or a lot of resources, and yet they never become an NCAA All-American, or they never, you know, graduate and becoming a professional runner, even though you would have picked them as a high school athlete because they broke this metric marker in this one race to do that. But if you looked at all the other data, how they placed at championship races or other, you know, races in their racing schedule, the placement, the absolute competitiveness of what place did they finish might not be in harmony or actually correlate to the time they ran.
Oh, that's so interesting. I want to ask you guys two more things because this is much more interesting than talking about my book. The first is, what is the equivalent of a hot hand in running? Like when you think of someone getting hot one day, what does that mean? And second, running is so regimented and you do know so much now. I mean, the whole sport is basically one big exercise in data and science, I feel like. Is there any data that sort of puts you in that mind to allow for a hot hand? Like, can you, in the same way that Steph Curry like says he can't predict it, can you actually predict it in running and in competition now?
Steve, I'll start off with the first question here. We do have one really famous example of a hot hand in running. It's this Kenyan runner, Henry Rono. And he set four world records on the track in about an 80-day period. And it ranged from the 10K, the 5K, and the steeplechase, right? So this was a really amazing period. And, you know, of course, he won, like, he was a collegiate athlete at the time and won all the NCAA titles and everything. But in this really short period, in 80 days, he rewrote the record books globally on his own too. Like, that's the thing. Like, when you set the steeplechase world record, which arguably might want to be one of the harder world records on, you know, because one of the harder disciplines, because there's a ballistic component, you know, comprised of it. He was by himself on a rainy day in March in Seattle. Like, yeah, I mean, my high school coach was in the race and he was worried about not getting lapped, but it was not, like you said, from Steph Curry or Vincent Van Gogh or Shakespeare. It was not the best external conditions or weather conditions. It was actually pretty crappy. And yet he still did it. But no other runner ever has in that period of time been that hot and been able just to basically demolish all the competition and also the world records at the time. And I think that for us is kind of like the pinnacle. We look at other athletes now who might set a record, like in the marathon, or a record here or there in a world record or even a national record, but they might do it once in one event, not, you know, several times over in a very short period.
And I think, as I said, I think we can look at this kind of zoomed out, and running's different because it's not like we get feedback on whether we're doing well or not after every shot, you know? But I think, like, there are instances, like John mentioned, of athletes just getting hot and just rolling. You know, I mean, that was how my best year in running, I dropped from a 4:17 mile PR to a 4:01 mile PR. And every time I ran the mile, practically, I ran faster. And I was just...
And do you know why? I mean, I'm sure that, like, that year stuck with you forever, but do you know why?
Do I? No. but the thing is this, and I think this is the feedback, and this is my answer. So if you look at, okay, if we can race faster every time, right? Okay. There was this college race that some of my athletes were running, okay, that was a college mile, low-key mile at a indoor track event at the University of Houston. And for whatever reason, when they started the timer, okay, the big clock that was right next to when you go by every lap, it was delayed by about 4 or 5 seconds. Okay. So when athletes were coming by and seeing their time, they were thinking they were running much faster than they actually were. And an interesting phenomenon occurred. There were about, I don't know, 12, 15 people in the race. And about 10 of them ran, even when you adjusted for those 4 or 5 seconds, right, and got the real time, they all ran PRs, right? And then there were 4 or 5 who just ran way slower than they ever had before. And when I was, you know, when I talked to some of the coaches and some of the athletes who were in this thing, it was just this dichotomy of some saw, oh my gosh, I'm running way faster than I am. Like, just ride it, keep going. I'm going to do this. Like, I'm killing it. And then there were others who saw that same feedback and saw, oh my gosh, I am going to, like, hit the most massive wall ever in the latter half of this race because, this is way too fast. I can't do this. And I think that gets back to this, like, interaction of confidence, risk, like, getting this feedback of how am I doing? And some people interpret, like, oh, I'm doing phenomenal. And that's our version of the hot hand. Just like after Steph Curry shoots three and makes three in a row, he says, oh, like, I'm hot. This is my day. Like, we get that same experience in running. It's just, like, modulated differently a little bit.
I think,
oh my
the
God,
onus
so
is
funny.
A
so
bit.
Just by thinking they were faster, they ran faster. It was basically like this, like, controlled experiment in the hot hand, right?
Yeah. And if you're interested, and I can send you some of this, is there's some really good research lately looking at fatigue, where where researchers in a lab will distort the feedback coming in. So they'll change the speed on the treadmill to make it seem like they're going faster or slower than they actually are. And again, it comes down to that bandwidth, right? If it's believable, a little bit believable and all that stuff, then athletes will react accordingly. And that, again, just it's like ties in directly to this like hot hand concept, I think.
Now, Steve, would you tell your runners when they went to this particular race that like that the clock was a little bit off, or would you encourage them to think that they were actually running 4 or 5 seconds faster than they were?
Yeah, so like this was a weird instance where it just like I don't know why the clock was off, it just happened. So no one knew. but like we all knew afterwards when I was like, man, he's good, but not that good, you know? But in that instance, like you let him ride with it, I think, you know? Because it's again this And this is the concept, and I think this gets back to your book, and the concepts in it is we really struggle with understanding like almost like what's good feedback, what's bad, what's reality, what's not. And in the world of sports psychology, we have these soft concepts of confidence and toughness and all these other things that we know we think matter, and we can kind of ascertain them by asking questions, but not truly and not really. And it's almost like the hot hand works because we get this like boost of confidence, this feeling good, this feeling like we're in this flow state. And no one really knows like, okay, how do we like, how does that directly translate to performance, and how does this matter? I mean, there's some great research on it, but it's not like we can get in a lab and say, oh, this exact thing happens, this exact physiological thing happens. Like this is how you get in that state.
Expectation and confidence too is important, I think, in creating the hot hand in running. We have like in running special tracks over the world that are deemed fast tracks or the track short. And so like the Stanford track for distance runners is a special track because twice a year there's a high level, in a normal year, a high level college race and then a high level professional race where people run quote unquote crazy fast times. Like the American record has been set in a 10K there multiple times. And so because we have kind of that pre-existing data on this track, now everyone expects and thinks that we go to this track here in the middle of Palo Alto, or there's another track in the middle of Los Angeles, or another track here in Portland, right? Where just because fast times happened or people with really high expertise showed up and demonstrated that expertise, now that expectation trickles down to everyone that this is where you go to run fast. And what happens is we get a clamoring where people now think on these other tracks elsewhere that are just normal, ordinary tracks, people can't run fast. They can prepare to run fast, but they can't do it there. And the interesting thing about this is when you juxtapose this reality that we live in now, where, you know, coaches and runners are, you know, usually on the track season, the distance running and middle distance running world, prepping their whole season around getting ready to run really fast at this track race, at this special track, it's just continuing to snowball that expectation because now they're gearing everything towards that. They're getting ready for that. And when they show up, they're expecting this. And so that confidence is raging, you know, super high. But then you compare that with Henry Rono's 4 world records in 80 days. These are not at special tracks. These are at just any old track. I mean, literally, like he set the 5 kilo record at Cal Berkeley track, just on his own.
It would be the equivalent if some arenas allowed, for whatever reason, allowed more people to score 30 points a game and others like tended to score 20 at another arena. It's a very,
it's kind of like, yeah, this happens like, in the NBA though. It's like certain NBA players think that certain gyms have soft rims and they really like shooting on those rims, right? And so have you guys ever thought about like if you're going to some track where you've never been before for some big race, like just tell one of your guys like in the 400 that you were told that like lane 8 is actually a little bit shorter and just see if that actually makes a difference.
That is a good question. I have not, but maybe it's worth experimenting with. And I think, you know, what we're getting at is this weird intersection of like psychology and performance.
Yeah. I mean, there's certain coaches who, and this isn't, you know, who will during workouts will give, you know, athletes the feedback They'll say, don't wear a watch. I'll tell you your split. And they, and I've had, you know, professional coaches who I mentored under give me these instructions too, to give the athletes a faster split than the reality of what they ran. So the athlete might have ran, say, 63 seconds for 400 meters, but the coach instructed me to give them a 2 second differential. So tell them they ran 61. And I think this is, you know, you're trying to now, whether you're gerrymandering this to, you know, fool the athlete, or whether you're trying to do it to enhance the psychology of the athlete, I think that's a very fine line that, you know, is being walked there. But there is, like we said, there is evidence that suggests, like, maybe on occasion, to give that athlete an elevated boost of confidence, telling them a little bit fibbing a little bit on the split they ran for, you know, a workout might be actually the right medicine for that period of time in their training and preparation.
Yeah, that's the lesson of this book. Lie to your athletes.
But so I'm gonna interject and then maybe we'll wrap up there. But it's interesting because I think this gets back to the book. It's like, if you lie to them, right, and they think they're running faster, but then if you do that...
Are you lying?
Yes, well, that's true. If you're doing that consistently, then their calibration for what they think is normal changes, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So it's like, yeah, you might give them this boost in confidence, but now they think that, like, how they feel running X time is this, when in reality it's not. So you might have just interfered with the performance.
Yeah, the only other, I wanted to make mention of our good friend, and who happens to be the American record holder in the mile, Alan Webb. You know, when he set the American record in the mile 20 years ago now, he ran 3:46. Since that time, no human on the planet has ran a mile faster. And he did it at just some random old track, right? Just in the middle of Belgium. But what happened was, during that period of time, he was on fire, you know, in the outdoor season. He set the American or the national championship record for the U.S. in the 1500 by himself. He ran, you know, a really fast and world-class time in the 800, which was unexpected. Then he sets the American record in the mile, and 3:46 is no joke. You know, a lot of his training and preparation and his workouts, he was doing things in practice that in and of themselves was, you know, you look at it and it's crazy, right? I mean, he's running 20 times a quarter and finishing at 50 flat for the last one, which is, you know, smoking. So there too, he had this confidence, and this confidence was accelerating because he wasn't being fibbed. He wasn't being lied to. If anything, he was super anal about it. But then that was the equivalent of being able to take, you know, like Steph Curry or, you know, those heat checks. He could do more outlandish things, but it wasn't perfect either. Like, he got greedy and he understood where his limits were, because he ran a really fast mile race, and then he and his coach and agent thought he could go just magically show up and break the American 2 mile record. And he did that a week after, or 2 weeks after, a really fast mile that he ran, and everyone had this excitement. But then he bombed the 2 mile race hard. And it was just this, it was this reality check of him to say, okay, hey, maybe I can't shoot from the other, you know, the opponent's other free throw line and make it. So he had to stay in a certain circle of competence. But then, you know, 2 weeks later, he comes back and wins the U.S. national title in the 15 and sets the championship record. Again, at a really crappy track. Like, I think it was in Indianapolis that year. It was hot and humid. It wasn't the conditions that one would think. So, you know, it's just, that's why I'm really interested in where these bounds of confidence and arrogance lies, because I've seen it myself with different athletes and also different friends.
And one thing to add there, I promise we won't go off on a tangent on running all the time, but it's interesting because, like, sometimes what I've noticed in running, and I'm curious, Ben, what you think about this in basketball, if it occurs, is people experience something like John just described, Alan Webb just on fire, just crushing his PRs, running super fast, feeling great doing it. Like, it comes with a little bit more ease than normal. Like, it feels like when you're just on fire in the basketball court and you're just nailing things. But then what happens is they start chasing that feeling. And they start mm-hmm. thinking, the only way I can perform is I need to feel like this. And then they struggle to get it back. Is that something that you see with NBA guys?
Well, I think that's, like, the issue of confidence becoming arrogance, right? And for sure, I mean, I think that in the NBA, they are well calibrated enough to know, or to at least think that this is like a short-term phenomenon, that that getting hot in one game may carry over to the next game, but it may not. And it also doesn't last for like a very long time. And that's why it's important to take advantage and to capitalize while you can. But for sure, I mean, it's like there's another corollary to all of this, which like for lack of a better word, would be like the cold hand, where you go through these mm-hmm. terrible slumps yeah. and you feel like you will mm-hmm. never break out of them either. And so clearly there is some random variation here, and that's like what we are still thinking about. But I do think that this issue between psychology and performance is kind of like the next frontier of hot hand studies. Like I don't think that this scientific literature is ending anytime soon. And I would be really fascinated to see some studies along these lines. Maybe you guys can take care of them for yourselves.
Awesome.
Perhaps one more question, Ben, right. just because we have you and I'm in Portland. You know, I'm curious to just with the hot hand and before we had this whole, you know, kind of outbreak and everything, you know, interpreting Damian Lillard's streak.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. So I want you to just through your lens, just talk me through a little bit about that, or if you looked into that at all from where you sit.
Well, what part about it? Just like how he was able to get on that streak in like January?
Yeah, how he got on that streak and then kept the streak going, and for as long as he kept the streak going. And maybe just give our readers a little bit of insight into the data or details of that streak. So they
know. Oh, well, if I remember right, I mean, he ripped off this run of like 5 or 6 games where he was averaging like 45 points a game, right? I mean,
yeah,
it was something absurd like that. You know, part of it, I think, if I remember correctly, was that McCollum was hurt, right? So clearly... Mm-hmm. there were some more resources available to him. And that's sort of a similar thing that happened to Steph Curry, which is that like his teammates were suspended. Like he had to play the whole game and he had to do things that he had never been able to do before. And he had never been asked to do before. And so I think part of this is like figuring out like what people are capable of and whether it's sustainable over the long term. Like that streak ended for Damian Lillard, right? I mean, this thing does not last forever. But I think that our performance in these hot hand periods actually shows some extraordinary things that we are able to do. And if we're able to do them for a short term, maybe we can do them over the long term. I mean, I think that's what crystallized for the Warriors about Steph Curry in that game, is that like if he can do this, if he can take shots that nobody had ever dreamed of taking before, maybe we should encourage him to do that. And you know, the results sort of speak for themselves. Like he won back-to-back MVPs and they won 3 of 5 championships. So I do think you kind of have to be Damian Lillard or Steph Curry to get permission to do that sort of thing, but we never quite know what people are capable of until we ask them to do things that they don't know that they are capable of.
And I think that's, you know, a very important point to make. Like sometimes these streaks are really micro. I think one thing too, you may want to interview or look into Edwin Moses's streak in the 400 meter hurdles that lasted for, I think he won 122 consecutive 400 meter hurdle races in the 80s.
Well, that's just being better than everybody else, right?
Yeah. I mean, pretty phenomenal streak. Yeah. But I mean, everyone, it's kind of like, it'd be the same thing as if, you know, the Golden State Warriors or any NBA team just won every single game for, you know, a 3 or 4 year period, like zero losses. Right. I think we can say it's better than everyone else, but at a certain time too, you know, there are races in there. Like it'd be interesting if someone looked at that data and looked at that in seeing like, okay, how big of a margin did he win races by? How narrow of a margin? When did it look like he might have been coming around in the last half of the race or last quarter of the race? Was he always in a winning position? Was he ever in a losing position? Track, you know, lends itself to being very crunchable in terms of data if you like segment and make it up. But yeah, that might be something just for you in your own curiosity to look a little bit more deeper into and see if you can interpret that.
Man, we're just coming up with all sorts of research studies here.
Yeah, I know, right? And we might have a lot of time to do it. Yeah. So, hey.
There you go. Well, awesome, Ben. Well, I just want to thank you again for coming on our podcast. For the listeners, if you haven't checked it out, The Hot Hand, The Mystery and Science of Streaks, we'll put a link in the show notes, but phenomenal book. Couldn't recommend it more, which hopefully you can tell by our conversation. Is there anything left that you need to tell readers or listeners where to contact you at or anything like that, Ben?
Oh, no, just, you know, all of the social media platforms that we all are trying to avoid these days. I'm at BZ Cohen at all of them. I'm very easy to find. And oh, my God, what a pleasure. Thank you guys so much for having me on.